Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Welcome to another Topically Yours show on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. Come on now, cozy up to your apps and computers and take this hour ride with me, your host as always, Deirdre Schuller. While we visit the lives of interesting folks who take the time to make a difference in people's lives. My guests are regular folks that make a decision that they will not be ordinary folks. They leave their mark through entertainment, sports, publishing, politics, science, and all of those diverse fields by which people distinguish themselves. These are people fallible, like any other. They stumble, but the trick is they don't stay down. They take their lumps, get up, dust themselves off, and find another way to step up to the challenges of life. My guest today has experienced the theatrics of life, made sport of it, and even follows a spiritual calling. He's been on stage, the small screen, and the large screen. He has founded and co-founded theatrical groups. Some of you may remember him best as Sergeant Curtis Baker in Carter Country, and as Tyler Hudson, the private investigator, in Matlock, starring, of course, Andy Griffith. The author of his own book entitled The Book of K3, The Contemporary Poetics of Kenny Holiday. My guest Kenny Holiday has appeared in several productions, including Law and Order, Diagnosis Murder, The Wayne Brothers Show, The Profiler, Quincy, and several others. Well, I guess by now you've guessed that my guest is Kenny Holiday, who is also presently the founder of Moto Theater Works, an organization that teaches their students how to write, videograph, and stage plays. Well, Kenny's here with us. And you know what he tells me? He says that some folks are allowed to call him Keen. And he gave me permission to do so.
Welcome, Keen. How are you?
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you, Deirdre. Thank you so very much for the invitation. And this is going to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to having some fun. And speaking of fun, I am a New Yorker, born upstate, raised upstate. Well, born in New York, but raised upstate. And you were raised in Long Island. And the last time I spoke with you, you were enjoying a cookout while watching the Olympics out in your yard. And as I had mentioned, that you were the one that told me about Gabby Douglas, because I hadn't been really paying attention to the Olympics, but I watched her last night do, well, she made the third gold last night. So America is now doing pretty well in the Olympics, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think, you know, what's really important to point out to people is we spoke at a critical moment, and the moment was that the United States women's gymnastics team had just won the team championship. And what I was pointing out to you was that Gabby, this little black girl, had been the fulcrum of their turnaround, because some of their senior members of the team had been falling apart. It was almost like a virus was going through that hall where all the different teams with all their veterans, they were just falling apart. The Russians, who are usually so steadfast, were falling apart. The Chinese, falling apart. They were all just falling apart. And Gabby pulled that team together. It's almost like she picked them up spiritually as well as fundamentally, and showed the way. She was perfect in the execution of everything that she was doing. She maintained her steadfastness. She maintained her composure. Now, you know, these are little girls. These are little 15.
I was about to say, how old is she?
She's like, 16 looks like a years old.
Wow.
And the world is watching. There's cameras everywhere. They got cameras moving on little remote dollies. They got guys running up alongside of you. So all of this stuff, lights are flashing all over the place. And if you're 16 years old, you know, you can get a little bit discombobulated. It can be a little frightening. It can throw you off your game. But she pulled that team together. She set the example. And she was real cool and quiet about it. She's praying. You know, you see her take that little moment where she's just praying and she's pulling her spiritual self together. And then she would go out and hit it perfectly. So that is what carried over to her winning the all-around championship. So she's like the best of all those girls. She came out number one. I thought that was so spectacular. I thought it was just an incredible statement throughout all the lands, because, you know, there was a time when they didn't consider black girls were good enough to be gymnasts. We were too big boned or too big butted, or
we
didn't have
ballet,
the right kind of smile. You know? But this little girl just showed the world who we are once again. We are irrepressible. We are undeniable. When the door opens, we don't step through. It's a bull rush.
Exactly. I think that's what they're afraid of. But yeah, but when we do it well.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah. I mentioned the Olympics for a reason, because, weren't you quite the athlete in your day? In fact, I looked you up and I saw that you had a nickname, Mr. Hotshot, on the football field.
Well, you know, this is going back to high school and in my early collegiate years. I was a very, very good football player. I was a county scoring champ in football. I was twice. I was all Long Island, all Suffolk, all Long Island, all league. I was a lot of things out there. And I was captain of my team for several years. And the reason that it was so great for me, I wasn't just a football player. I was in the academic college prep curriculum line. There was only two African Americans in my class from fourth grade all the way up to 12th grade. And that was myself and another gentleman by the name of Joseph Joyner. Now, I was thrust into these people, into this group, because the track that they had me in, at that point in time, it used to be A, B, and C. A, you were college prep. B, you were, you know, going in for general and commercial education, whatever you could do. C, you were basically, you know, you had learning disabilities. And they had me in B, but like I had quote-unquote behavioral issues. And the reason was I would finish up the work real quick, and then I'm looking around, what else can I get into here while everybody's still working? So what my mother did, because they were getting ready to put me out of there, you know, it was like, hey, look, we might have to find some place for this guy to go to school elsewhere. My mother said, well, wait a minute. What is wrong? What's the problem? Is he got problems with, let me see his scores. Hey, his test scores aren't great. Wow, his test scores are good. His IQ is really good. She said, well, you know what? You need to put him someplace where he doesn't have time to look up ever. He needs to be working all the time. And that is exactly what they did. They put me in with the college prep kids and said, this is your last chance. But from fifth grade on, that's where I lived. So when I went to college, I wasn't just a dumb jock that walked through the door. When I walked through that door in college, you know, I was verbal in Shakespearean history and literature. I was knowledgeable of the mathematical formulas. You know, I knew world history. I knew geography very well.
Well, what was your major?
In college?
Mm-hmm.
I was an education major, speech and drama education.
Oh, okay.
So I'm an educator, and I'm one of the best that they ever graduated out of that particular curriculum. As a student teacher, I directed the state, Maryland State Drama Championship school entry from Wild Lake High School in Columbia, Maryland. I directed it.
And well, did you have a minor in theater or whatever? I know you majored in education.
Education and theater was, with an emphasis in theater.
Okay.
Now, the important part about that is I had been dismissed from my previous student teaching assignment because I utilized a curriculum that was deemed to be provocative. There was an educational treatise traveling around at that time. This was 1970. And the treatise was entitled The Student as Nigger. And what it was really talking about was that people, students of that era, you know, we were in the fierce 70s, everybody's, you know, we're making massive changes in our society and how we think about things. And this article was about how students didn't have a choice or any hand in the direction of their education. You were given a plate of gruel, and that's what it was. And so my high school students decided they wanted to use that as the basis of the play that they wrote. By the way, the same curriculum that I was using then, I'm still using now. I allow my students to educate me through their writings. Okay. So anyway, I had 3 AAA ratings as far as my observations from my overseeing teachers and instructors from the university. AAA. Oh, man, this guy's a great teacher. And I am. I'm a very good teacher. Why? Because I don't like to be bored. That's the worst thing that can happen to a person that has got a really active mind, to be just stodgified. So anyway, they come out. They didn't come out for the fourth one. The teacher that was my immediate supervising teacher where I was doing my student teaching, they got wind of the fact that this article was being used, the student as nigger. Some parent complained that there was a word nigger being used, and they unceremoniously dismissed me from my student teaching assignment, which meant that I wasn't going to graduate with my class. And so they're looking at me like, hey, there's nothing we can do. You got dismissed. I said, no. At the time I had some very good mentors and people that were backing me up, one of which was a gentleman who was an attorney by the name of James Michael Bailey. James Michael Bailey was the good friend of Dr. Roger Mearsman, who was my educational mentor. And James Michael Bailey was an attorney. And James Michael Bailey had tried 2 cases before the Supreme Court of the United States and won big cases. And I said, no, there's not going to be a problem here because I'm going to bring my Uncle James and we're going to rip this place asunder in legal work. So they found me another assignment, which was this brand new school that they started in Columbia, Maryland, called Wild Lake High School. And I had to travel all the way from Washington, D.C., Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., every morning to go out to Wild Lake. It was like 40 minutes, almost an hour and a hour, hour and a half or something like that. It was just crazy. However, I got out there, I put the same curriculum in order, of course, different kids, different needs and desires and thoughts. And we put together this thing. I asked the supervising teacher when I arrived, what is it that you want me to do? You know, I'm really frustrated. He said, I've been trying for 7 years to win the state championship in drama. I said, that's what you want? He said, yes. And that's what I did. So I go forth once again to say, I never walked into a place feeling like I was less than. I went in with purpose and with preparation.
And well, let's depart from school. And what was your first professional endeavor? I see that you were, I don't know, this was in the university, though. You were the first African-American to star in a lead role in the university, correct?
Well, it's exactly correct, but there is some definition that needs to be understood. We had two different theaters. We had what was called ET, Experimental Theater, which is a little black box kind of theater with boxes for set pieces. And that's where we did most of our classroom work. And then there was TAWS Fine Arts, which is the full presentational theater, the main stage. And prior to me, black people that worked on main stage in a show carried a tray and said, more tea, sir.
Mm.
Well, I came along, and Roger Mearsman cast me in Eugene O'Neill's The Hairy Ape. Now, don't be thrown off by the name.
I was about to say, quite the title.
Well, let me tell you why. Only people that are kind of my age will know this. But there was a show many, many, many years ago when television was black and white called The Life of Riley or Life with Riley. And the gentleman that was the star of it, and I'm sorry, but his name escapes me right now, but I'll think of it in a little minute. Anyway, that gentleman became famous on Broadway doing Eugene O'Neill's The Hairy Ape. And it was a polemic about men being outside of the social register, you know, how we try to break through from one level of society into another society, and you can be totally alienated when you get there. So this particular character that I played was named Yank, and Yank was a stevedore in ocean liners. They shoveled coal, these guys, these muscular men. These beautiful men. And so we were on stage, these men. You know, I'm a football player back then. I'm looking good. You know, I'm cut. Everybody's beautiful. And and I'm the leader of the pack in this thing. And it was a show that broke all the records, as opposed to
Kenny, I'm just asking you a question.
Yeah,
was it
well,
a play,
you know,
that was just all male cast?
No, it wasn't all male. You got to have women, you know, to have an allure, something to be. See, a woman in that environment is the unattainable. You know, he would see that which he wanted, but that it was unattainable. So, in his quest to be a part of that, you know, he misses. Okay, now he tries to come back to his own environment, and as Tom Wolfe said, you can't go home again. You can go back to the geographical place, but those things which constituted home, the intangibles which constituted home, that's all changed now. And you can't go fit right back in where you have left. And so anyway, this thing became a big, big hit there. And, you know, I got all kinds of PR. I got more famous in theater than I ever would have as a football player there.
So how did you get to the Folger Theater? How did you
I went
to that?
It's a great story. I went with my girlfriend at the time, who was going to try out for this Shakespearean theater company. Okay, I said, all right, well, I'll go with you, but I'm not doing any more Shakespeare. I've had my fill of that for now. And so I'm sitting there, and the guy is explaining to me, a gentleman by the name of Richmond Crinkley, the late Richmond Crinkley, and he was this Virginia gentleman. By the way, the Folger Shakespeare Library has a miniaturized version of the Globe Theater in one of its wings, and they had, up until Richmond Crinkley came along, they would only use it as a stop on the tour of the library. The library is located right on Capitol Hill, right across the street from the Supreme Court, two blocks away from the Capitol building, and adjacent to the Library of Congress annex. And Henry Clay Folger, first president of Standard Oil, I believe it was called Standard Oil at that time, he was the one that owned all of Capitol Hill, basically. And that's where he built, this was his fetish, Shakespeare. And so he had the world's greatest collection in Western America, the Western Hemisphere, of Shakespearean memorabilia. It is a magnificent edifice. And so that was my home for 3 years while I was a founding member of the Folger Theater Group. But anyway, how it happened is he asked me to come up and participate and explain that they would do not only straight Shakespearean works, but there are many contemporary interpretations of Shakespeare and 17th century works. So I said, okay, you know, I'll give it a try. So they were doing a musical, a rock musical, was going to be their first piece. I sang Oscar Brown Jr.'s Signify and Monkey, and got a job. My girlfriend didn't. And the rest is history. So I wind up living on Capitol Hill in one of the properties of the Folger Library for 3 years, and I was hot stuff. I was hot.
Well, how'd you meet Robert Hooks?
Robert Hooks had a notification while I was still at the University of Maryland. He had a notification in the newspaper that he was going to start a theater company in Washington, D.C. I read it, and I took myself and my crew from University of Maryland, because I had put together an alternative theater company, if you will. You know, see, University of Maryland had recently desegregated when I got there, so there was a lot of folks there that didn't want us, didn't like us, you know, didn't treat us real well. And if I was going to be a drama major, I could not depend upon the prevailing makeup of the department to be assets to me in my pursuit. So we created the Black Student Union Black Drama Club, Black Student Union Drama Club. And a couple of my buddies were the moving factors in that along with me. So I brought my own team, basically. And I cast, you know, from a wide range of people as opposed to having to deal with the resident population. And that's how I, you know, really became known, because I was doing Imamu Baraka's works. I was doing all kinds of revolutionary theater work as well as the classics.
Well, that was the Washington, D.C. version of the New York NEC, Negro Ensemble.
Right. Well, when Robert had this big meeting, he had a big meeting at Howard University. And I took my crew from the University of Maryland down there, Jay Stewart, Jennifer Baker, who would eventually be my wife, Jennifer Baker Holiday, Belinda Cooper, Carla Witcher, and we all went out there to this meeting. And that's when I met Robert for the first time. And he talked about his dream of having this theater company. Robert is from D.C., and he wanted to, he was coming back to D.C. to live, and he wanted to build this theater company, which was essentially the sister company of the Negro Ensemble Company in New York, which he co-founded with
Gerald Cronin and Douglas Turner Ward.
So I said, well, you know, in school I met Robert, but it wasn't going to happen right away. And when it did happen, I was firmly and very comfortably ensconced at the Folger. And like, I am not leaving. I'm on salary here. I get paid every week. I'm not going anywhere to do anything. And Vantile Moto Gico Whitfield came to see me in a production at the Folger because everybody else had gone on to be in the workshops for the DC Black Rep, and I'm like the last one. I'm the last holdout. So they've been hearing about me. So Moto came to see a show and said, "Man, you got to come on up and be a part of the workshops." I said, "Man, I don't do workshops. I don't know. I don't need no workshops. I got a job here." He said, "But everybody does a workshop. That's how we cast for the main productions, you know." Anyway, they kept after me, and then my woman was there, you know, and my friend. Oh, and Smokey Stevens was also one of the people from Maryland. And so they finally convinced me to go in and peek in on a couple of the workshops. And some things changed at the Folger. There was a shift in the management, and Richmond Crinkley left, and there was another guy in charge. And so it was just an opportune time for me to make the transition, and I fit it right in. We had a great family. I was there for 4 years, and I did everything from stage to stage managing, set construction. I learned tons and tons from Moto, and that's who my theater company is named after. Uh-huh. Vantile Moto Gico Whitfield, because he was a monster of a man. He was a wonderful man. He was a brilliant man, a Renaissance man. He was one of the first African-Americans to be a set designer for Paramount Studios in Los Angeles. He ran a theater company in Los Angeles called Pazla, where many of the people that you saw in the early sitcoms, Red Fox and Good Times and all that, were people that he developed. And he also
I know as the role came out of Robert Hooks's NEC in New York.
Correct. Well, Moto was an L.A.-based guy, and all of the folks that you saw in the early sitcoms that had black folks in it came out of his workshops, which was mm-hmm. called Pazla. And
is that how you headed for California?
I did a show at Lincoln Center after I left immediately after I finished my 4 years at DC Black Rep. I was very blessed. I got an audition for a show at Lincoln Center that Joseph Papp was producing. And it was called Streamers. Mike Nichols was directing.
Good people.
I didn't know who Mike Nichols was. I just went in and did the audition. A friend of mine had informed me of it. And the thing about my relationship with Joseph Papp was, Joe Papp and Richmond Crinkley had a great relationship. And Joe would use the Folger as sort of his minor leagues for his directors. If he wanted to check out a director, or if there was a director that, you know, needed a gig, he would send them down to the Folger on a project, and then Joe, of course, would come down when the show opened and take a look at it. So Joe essentially had been monitoring my work while at the Folger for about 3 years. So when it came down, Mike Nichols said, "Okay, you're good. You know, you're good for Streamers, playing the role of Carlisle." And Carlisle, I don't know if you don't know Streamers, Carlisle was one of those David Rabe Vietnam-era plays. And Carlisle was like another level of Yank, the disassociated trying to fit into a place in society. So it's like Yank grew up a little bit, okay? And so anyway, I got this job. And when Joe walked in the door and saw me, he took one look at me. He said, "Oh, it's you. Yeah, you're going to do fine." And he started to walk back out. I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Listen." I said, "I want to do it." He said, "Listen, do you understand that at this point, you can only lose?" I said, "I want to do it." And they're talking about my audition. So he sat down. I did it. I did it flawlessly. He said, "Okay, you got the job. Now, just remember, This guy's a light switch. He turns it on, he turns it off. I'll see you later. Anyway, the show was supposed to run for 2 weeks. The actor that had the show at the opening did it for almost a month, and within that month he had a pilot in Los Angeles for a new television series. So I was the replacement. I was supposed to do it for 2 weeks. Things changed once again. Things happened, and that 2 weeks turned into 11 months. The show became a huge hit because everybody wanted to know, who is this new guy down at Lincoln Center tearing up the joint? Oh, by the way, Carlisle would have an inadvertent, he would have an inadvertent incident each show where two white people would wind up dead on the floor bleeding profusely from his switchblade. But in between all the rest of that, he was a brilliant performer. It was awesome stuff. But let me tell you, hot show. Robert De Niro, who I would, you know, that's one of the credits, by the way, that you missed. I did a show with, film with Mr. De Niro called Everybody's Fine in 2010. It came out 2011, I do believe it was. But anyway, Robert De Niro's baby girl, who is now, you know, big-time star herself on the way, he sat in the lobby watching the show on closed screen, closed-circuit television, because he had to see this show about with this new guy in it named Keen Holiday. And it took many, many years, but we finally got together to do a movie together. Anyway,
so was that your first movie?
No, what happened was, that was on closed circuit in the theater at Lincoln Center, the Mitzi Newhouse. He was sitting out in the lobby because he had the baby. The baby was getting noisy, so, you know, he sat out in the lobby and watched it on the closed circuit televisions out there. But when I left Streamers at the end of my 11 months, I had a contract for my first sitcom, Carter Country, in my pocket.
You had auditioned for that out of California?
Yeah, I was gone. I went right from Lincoln Center to California and stayed in California for 25 years.
Wow.
It was an awesome, awesome time in my life.
Well, you worked a lot out there. I assume that a lot of the... I didn't name everything because there's too much to name, but I left that up to you to tell us some of those good stuff of the programs that you work with. When you were out there, you certainly did The Profiler, as I mentioned, and the Josephine Baker story. Now, you did that with Lynn Whitfield?
I did that with Lynn Whitfield. We shot that in Budapest, Hungary, and various other places in Hungary. And many of the dancers that you see in that show, when they're walking through, they're going through the streets and they're doing all the you know, the dancing and everything. All of those, most of those are people from DC Black Repertory Company. She brought the family to support her in the making of this film, and I was part of that. And I was very proud that she chose me to play Sidney Bechet, the jazz soprano saxophonist, who was he's one of the first of the expatriates that went to Europe and found great success there, because there was, during that time, there was no racial prejudice in France. They were enamored, as they did for Josephine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was a great experience, you know, just to be there to support Lynn. And Lynn won everything with that movie. You know, she won the Emmy for Best Actress. She won, you know, screenplay. She married this man who was a fabulous director. She got the baby during that time. It was just a magnificent time for her. Everything went right for her on that. She had a house in London. She had a house in L.A. She had a house in New York. You know, it all went right for her. At that time, that was the beginning of a great career for Lynn.
Well, I also want to mention you were on Law and Order and Benson and Soap and Diagnosis Murder and Doogie Howser.
I played Benson's brother. That's Robert Guillaume, and you know, Guillaume and I had known each other for years. And I did Soap also. I did three episodes of Soap. I played Lynn Moody's brother on Soap. So I did like four episodes on soap. But I was Benson's brother on that show. I did, I think I did three Bensons also. And those are, you know, that's like big time stuff out there in California. Everybody's trying to get one little opening, and here I am, you know, I'm landing these three show deals and things like that. And the guys that I'm hanging out with, all, you know, the other black actors, they're like, "Hey man, what are you doing here? You're just like taking everything." And it's like, "Hey,
well,
fellas,
you had a principal role in Carter Country, didn't you?"
I was the co-star. It was
right.
It was Victor French who. Victor had come over from Little House on the Prairie. Played played the gruff old guy on Little House on the Prairie. Him and Michael Landon were running buddies.
Right.
And what people really didn't know was that every other Little House on the Prairie, Michael Landon and Victor would alternate who was going to direct. So they didn't know. They thought that Victor was just a gruff old guy on Little House on the Prairie, but he was actually one of the foundation members of the team. Him and when he and Michael Landon did Highway to Heaven, it was the same deal. They alternated directing. So Victor was a big time guy, and here I am. I don't know from nothing. You know, I'm showing up here, this rookie. And he embraced me, you know, he took me under his wing, he showed me how to get this sitcom thing done, and, you know, he would keep me protected from a lot of the outside exigencies of life that would mess you up. And I really loved hanging out with Victor. Victor was my guy, and we'd go bowling together, you know, that was a real pal relationship. He was that kind of guy.
So tell me about, well...
Also, by the way, before we go on, Brene Watson, who played Fresh Prince's real mama on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Brene Watson was my love interest on Carter Country. And we got married in the very last episode. If the show had been called anything but Carter Country, if it had been called Clinton Corners, like they wanted, or country corners, we probably still had a job. But because it was called Carter Country and the election was coming up versus Carter versus Reagan, and they made my show disappear. A top 10 show, they made it disappear.
But then you went on to Matlock.
Yeah, but Matlock was quite a few years later. In between Carter Country and Matlock, Carter Country was 77, 78, somewhere like 79. Matlock wasn't until 86. So in between, there was a lot of pilots, a lot of made-for-television movies, a lot of movies, a lot of guest star parts. So a lot of stuff to do, you know, to make a living between those hits.
Right, but Matlock was your next big hit that people definitely identify you. Now your face...
The
more
biggest
less,
hit.
With,
Nobody
with,
knew. You know, mm-hmm. you really, even though you had Andy Griffith sitting there with you, you know, who? Bob Guillaume had this on his license plate. Who knew? Who knew? And, you know, you just don't know. I mean, you're used to doing shows. You do a couple shows, but the thing goes on the air for a while. You make a little money, and it's gone. Who knew that now? This
that
is now 27 years later.
How did usually the big star has to like you, correct? I mean, you audition, but
yeah, I auditioned. I walked in the room, and all of this happened in one day. I was doing voiceover work over in Burbank. I got a call from my manager. Said, "Can you get over to Century City? They want to see you for this pilot." I said, "Of course, I can do that." So I left Burbank, went all the way over to Century City. And they handed me a script. I sat in the lobby for about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and I went in. I did an audition for Ruben Cannon, who is Ruben today is huge out there. He's a big-time producer and everything. But then he was a casting director. He was the first African-American full-blooded casting director in Hollywood. And this was going to be his first really big deal. And So Ruben, I did the audition for Ruben and a couple of the producers and a writer who happened, producers happened to be Fred Silverman, who was the head of programming at ABC when I did Carter Country, and this young man named Dean Hargrove that I never met, never heard of, but who is one of the great writers and producers in Hollywood. And so they said, okay, we'll see you later. So I went back to Burbank, go back to finish my voiceover deal, because that was my money. And while I'm there, they said, you got to go back to Century City at 4 o'clock. I said, why? They want to see you again. I said, oh, God, okay. So this must be getting good. I go back at 4 o'clock, and I walk in the room, and there's Andy Griffin. I'm like, whoa, all right, this is good. So I did the scene with Andy Griffin, and I went home. And they said, well, we'll let you know. And there were a couple other gentlemen there, but they were all older than me. You know, so I was trying to figure out what the heck is going on here. And there were a couple other gentlemen, African-American gentlemen, but they were all much, much older. Seniors, you know, if you will, like Andy. Anyway, at 9 o'clock that night, my phone rang, and they said, hey, you got the pilot. Welcome aboard. Now, this
wow.
all happened in less than 12 hours, and it changed my life.
I bet it did.
Yeah, because I was on my way back to New York. I tell you the truth, I was getting ready to leave Los Angeles and head back to New York.
Well, what was it like working with Andy Griffin?
Andy Griffin is a quintessential professional. And he got that homey, you know, home guy kind of presentation, but that guy is so smart. He is so sharp business-wise and work ethic-wise and knowing the ins and outs of when to play and when to, you know, be on the money. And I learned a tremendous amount. I learned a lot about courage also. When we started, when we did the pilot, he was still recovering from a very serious injury. He had fallen off a ladder on his house. You know, he's the real deal, country guy. He's up there cleaning his gutters, and he fell. And when he fell on a nail, so he got a tetanus shot. Well, he had some particular nuance in his body that responded negatively to the tetanus shot, and it paralyzed him. It almost killed him. And so when we did the pilot, he was still walking with these supports on underneath his pants, on his from his ankles all the way up to his calves. And nobody, you know, would know. But this guy was in pain most of the time that he was standing before the cameras. The other thing was, Andy didn't use cue cards. Everything was in his head. And likewise, everybody had to do the same, you know. Everything had to be in our head. The only time he would ever use a cue card is if there was a long list of names or places or directions or something like that that was in the script. Then he would have them write it up for expediency of time. But
so
I learned, you know,
the
all these
script?
Things, how to, you know, make a set work for you, how to do the work in an expedient manner, how to make yourself special. And I created a persona during that time called One Take Holiday. And the reasoning behind this was, how can I make myself very, very valuable? And I made a deal with the cameraman and the cinematographer that we would, on scenes that just involved me and guest stars and things like that, that we would shoot the rehearsal. So we would set up everything so that we can shoot the rehearsal, and then when we shot the first take, that would actually be the second take. And that really would be all that we'd need for the editors to have some choices. And by doing that, I saved the company a tremendous amount of money and expedited our work day all the time. So they, you know, they kind of liked me for that. Not only was I performing very nicely, but it saved the company a lot of money.
Well, Kenny, now I want to identify the station. You are listening to the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Soul. I'm Deirdre Shuler, your host, and we are talking to Keene Holiday. Some of you remember him from Carter Country and Matlock and Theaters. And, You know what? We have a gentleman that's been waiting for a while to talk to you. Shall I let him ask his question?
Please do.
All right. Hold on. Sir?
Oh, hi. Hi, Kenny. This is Gary Collins II from Ypsilanti. Hey, how are you?
How is it up there in, what is that, Michigan? Ypsilanti?
Yep.
There you go. Up there, way up there.
Hey, what's happening?
Hey, all is well, my brother. All is well.
Everything's going great. Now that you brought up Andy Griffith, I got a question. Were you a fan of the Andy Griffith Show before you got to work with Andy Griffith on MetLife? And was it rumored that the both of you did not get along, according to the computer?
No, that's not true at all. And, you know, you got to watch what happens there. Now, number one, no, I didn't watch Andy Griffith on a regular basis. I knew all the characters, Opie and, you know, what is the guy that...
Barney Fife.
Yeah, you know, all of well, I got to work with all those people. I got to work with Don Knotts when Don came on our show for... season. I think that was the third season I was there. Don came on to the show. But I knew all the characters. Yeah, and I watched it occasionally. But, no, I was not a big fan. I like mysteries. I like the cop shows, and I like, you know, the mystery shows or things like that. So, you know, the folksy humor. I never really liked shows like Gilligan's Island. You know, I'd watch it a little bit, but that really wasn't my thing. But to be in the presence of the man that did this, you have to acknowledge, see, in our business, you have to acknowledge greatness when you're in the midst of it, whether or not you liked that particular genre, what he did before. It had nothing to do with what we were doing on Matlock. What we were doing on Matlock was a completely different entity, and I got a chance to, you know, really appreciate the professional that Andy Griffith was. And it's not true that we did not get along. Man, I'm telling you, Andy Griffith opened the door for Ken Holliday, and Andy Griffith kept Ken Holliday there. I never have said a cross word about him. And, you know, the man changed my life. He and Dean Hargrove and Fred Silverman were the main people that made the decision, along with Reuben Cannon, and they changed my life. So, you know, there was nothing for me to be upset about. I really had a ball doing that show. They took me all over the world, man. We traveled outside the country, went to London, shot a two-hour episode in London. We shot all over the United States and different parts of California. I saw more parts of California than I knew existed. So I had a great time doing the show, and I was, you know, I was well paid.
Oh, you did? Well, that's very nice.
Well, sir, thank you for asking your question. We're going to move on with the show now. And
okay.
We appreciate it. We hope you still continue to listen.
All right. You be blessed.
Deirdre.
So, mm-hmm.
Deirdre, can I bless you with something real quick? I would like to read you a piece of my poetry. Can I do that for you?
Oh,
real
that'll
quick?
Be great. That'll be great.
This piece is called Footfalls, and what it comes from my track running days when we ran track, and I was a track champion and relay champion. We ran on the old cinder tracks where, you know, it's crushed anthracite coal. So when it gets into those spikes and gets thrown up, it can hurt. So the idea is to not run in the back of the pack. So this is called Footfalls. The heavy breaths of the first day of practice, any practice really, but this is spring and this is track. The footfalls, multi-cadence, side to side and back. There's one rule in track: if you don't want a diet of cinders, never, ever, never run in the back of the pack. And it's spring again, and I'm breathing hard and sweating, and footfalls abound, and last year's victories are memories, and I'm starting all over again, and I'm feeling like a winner, my friend. Head of the pack, footfalls, side to side and back. Seems like my whole life has been motivated by the fear of that loser's lament. Well, we'll get them next year. Hit a triple in the bottom of the ninth, championship on the line. Get a buckle in the knees on the ensuing side squeeze, and you're out! Well, we'll get them next year. 2 seconds to go on a 35-yarder, a kick on a field that you know the kick is up and up. and floats an inch to the right, and victory's glory floats from my sight, and blood-thudding ears hear. Well, we'll get 'em next year. But there aren't enough tears for all those next years. And all the locations I've worked my machinations, Long Island, New York City, New Haven, New England, Old England, Buffalo, Yugoslavia, don't you know, Detroit, D.C., Louisiana, Alabama, Palermo, Nice, Atlanta, Florida, Denver, Phoenix, St. Paul, L.A., Maui, Cancun, T.J., Zimbabwe, Budapest, Beijing, and all the rest, always trying to keep the cinders out my eyes and off my chest. A new job, a new car, a new woman, a new woman, a new woman, a new wife, a new wife, a new resolution not to make the same mistake twice, losing money, making money, new high-buy friends, a new resolution not to make the same mistakes again and again, old phone books, old numbers, old loves, infatuations, acquaintances, names with lost faces on a found matchbook cover. Hello, can I speak to Marcy? Marcy don't live here no more. Can we try it all over again? New dances, new fashions, new places to be, but what about the me within? Can I withstand starting all over again? Will the ghost of my past avail me or derail me and nail me to the wall? Can I pick myself up after this last five-story fall? Can I get back in the race and keep the cinders out my face? Hey, when all's said and done, got to say I'm one lucky son. I know that I'm blessed to have missed the abyss. I'm not enslaved to Count Crack. I'm modern-day Dracula, or living in Needle Park, scheming my next jump start, or sucking blended ethyl of moon howling dog that's all bark, or a walking disease, dead, trading death dances and Rasta spiel head dread. Ain't nothing, nothing, man. These earthly restarts seem taxing and painful and all that, but an astral, spiritual restart from dwelling in the abyss. Let me put it this way. I remember how I got myself into this mess that I got myself into in this life. I don't remember choosing to get in this life. That must have been an arc of a choice. In the main, like all the rest, I'm just trying to keep them cinders out my eyes and off my chest. Footfalls of the pack, side to side and to the back. Always side to side and always to the back. Thank you.
Wow, that was something.
Football.
I saw where it touched a lot of your who you are.
Yes, ma'am.
Your life.
That is from my book of poetry, the book of K3, the Contemporary Poetics of Keene Holiday.
And where can someone get that book?
The only availability right now is Amazon.com, but every once in a while there's a copy that pops up, a copy or two, so it's available.
All right, so folks that are listening in, if you like that, you might like some more, so go to Amazon.
There you go.
Order it.
We are closing in on the end of our visitation, Deirdre.
Yes, not too much longer.
This went so fast.
But we're not finished yet.
Okay, then let's get on with it.
I want to bring it all the way and show all sides of you. I read that your father died early on in your life. Was that so?
Yes, my father passed when I was 12. He was a submariner in World War II, and he went into that service for the United States. A very healthy and incredibly wonderful athlete and trumpet player, and things happened down there in those cans underwater. And somehow he got poisoned and his lungs were damaged. And my father passed away when I was 12 years old from emphysema that was onset by his service to the United States.
Well, did that bring you much closer to your mom? Because You were a caretaker to her when she got much older?
Yes, absolutely. I was my mom's only chicken. That was the only chicken that she had, and she was a Leo. And she did her job. My mama was a great, great woman. My mother was one of the first African-American telephone operators hired by Bell Telephone here in Long Island, New York. She had, you know, in order to be an operator, she had to have impeccable speech. And she was a business college graduate. So my mother was a very smart lady, and she was tough. She was a little lady, but she was tough as nails, and she didn't mind giving you a piece of her mind. She stood her ground, and I was part of that. You know, she was tough on me, but she also loved me. Any place that I was performing, any place that I was doing it, running that football, playing baseball, running track, my mama, if her job allowed it and she would work the schedule, my mama, my grandmama, and my Auntie Norma, I called them the Three Musketeers. They would be right there all the way, I'm telling you, they made it all the way to California to see me open up in shows. They Washington, D.C., at the Kennedy Center, they were sitting right there, third row center, right there, every time.
She developed Alzheimer's later on, is that how you got involved with the Alzheimer's organization?
Yes. My mother developed some rare form. It never was really diagnosed as Alzheimer's. It was a form of dementia. Perhaps there had been some type of cerebral anomaly that took place. It wasn't a stroke, but something had taken place that caused her to have the outward appearances of Alzheimer's, but it wasn't. She was still very coherent, and then some days she was more coherent than others. But the main thing was I decided that I did not want to live the latter part of my life regretting not having given her as much care as she gave me as a young man. So wherever I went, Mama got in the car, put Mama in the car, put her bag in the trunk, and we would take off. We would go all over the country together.
Wow, that's so great.
Oh, she was cool, you know. And she was kind of strange in the car, but this is funny. Mama would look straight ahead. She's looking at the road all the time. And you think that she's not paying attention. She's looking at the road all the time. And I would try to test her, and I would try to break her glance. I'm like, why don't you look at some of the scenery that we're passing? Mama looking at the road. And there were three separate occasions that I can tell you. And we logged thousands and thousands of miles together. But there were three separate occasions where my mother, sitting there looking at, staring at the road day and night, said, "Hey, look out!" And sure enough, saved us from impending danger.
Wow.
You know, Mom was there. Mom was coherent. Mom had an attitude some days, and some days she was sweet as pie. And some days she didn't want to hear it from nobody. You understand? But the bottom line was, that was a woman that gave me her very all and loved her son. And all that I did, I made sure my mom got her due, you know.
Can't
and they would always look at it, Miss Holiday's son. And she would know she wasn't boastful. She just went about her business. But she just,
we're
she was
run
so
into
proud
overtime.
Of me.
But I want to ask you, and we'll just go into overtime about Walk on Water, because that seems like a very interesting venture that you're involved in.
Yes, a young man by the name of Jacob Curtin, K-I-R-T-O-N. Walk on Water Productions is Jacob's company. Now, this all started with a pastor handing me a little manuscript. He said, "This is my nephew. See what you can do with this." So I thought, okay. He's a wonderful man, Pastor Roy Curtin of Circle of Love Church here in Coppay. He's a wonderful community activist. So I said, okay, Pastor. And I open it up and start reading it, and the whole thing is in prose. And it is a fantasy adventure based in the East. So it's a samurai kind of story. I'm like, who in the world wrote this? Look at this. It's so common. It's the Seven Scrolls of Chitauriō. And it's all seven scrolls are written in this beautiful prose. And I said, well, okay, let me meet this young man. So I meet Jacob. And I said, well, what do you want to do? He said, well, I'd like to, you know, Kenny, I'd like to make it into a movie one day. I said, well, okay, let's talk about doing that. Anyway, we found out that the best way to get this story to some of the feature film, animation feature filmmakers, is to either do it as a comic book or to publish it as a graphic novel. So we found an artist, a young man by the name of Harold Booker Jr. I stumbled on Harold. I know his daddy. I didn't know Harold was talented, but I met him one day at his daddy's place of work. His daddy is an auto body specialist and painter. And so the three of us, Harold, myself, and Jacob, we have formulated, we put our three companies together, Moto Theater Works. Harold has a company, I think it's called Green Eyes something, and Jacob is Walk on Water Productions. And under that, we have now put together a magnificent book that we are about to publish, and it is called The Seven Scrolls of Chitauriō, and I am extraordinarily proud of these two young men. We've been working on this project now. We're in our second year, and as we come out of the second year, going into our third, we're about to publish this incredible book, and you'll be really impressed at the work that they've done. And I thank you very much for bringing it up. So it's walkonwaterproductions.us if you'd like to take a look at the website that Jacob has put together. And I'm really proud of these guys. This is what I do. I mentor young people, and it doesn't matter what their color is or what their ethnicity is. If you want to learn some of the things that I know, I would be glad to share them. I'm a guy from Amityville. Amityville got a bad rep with a lot of people. The only thing they knew about Amityville was the movie, the horror. Jaws is also from Amityville, but he's kind of like a star, you know. But there was a thing about the African-Americans from Amityville never quite amounting to anything. And I tried very desperately to break that mold. And now I'm back in this community. I'm working on my theater company. I'm working in embellishing the literary standards of our community, because everything we put on stage as a conglomerate rewrite out of Moto Theater Works. And I'm very proud of the work that I'm doing. I'm happy working with young people. Everybody young now, based according to me, everybody's young. But I'm really having a great time with it. I'm motivated daily. So tomorrow I got a big deal with my workshop on Monday.
Well, if they're interested in becoming part of Moto Works, who do they get in touch with? Or
you can email me at Moto Theater with an Theater 09 at AOL.com. That's Moto Theater with an ER09 at AOL.com. We will definitely respond to you, and we will give you more information how to get in touch with us and come join us. My doors are open to all. All I ask is that you give me 100% and that you come on a regular basis so that we can make progress. I'm a man about progress.
Well, on that note, there's so much more to talk to about and talk to you with, but the curtain is fallen.
Deirdre, thank you so very much.
And Joe, but thank you for coming on and being quite a stimulating and interesting guest. We always appreciate that, and taking the time to get into someone's life as much as we can for an hour.
God bless you. Hallelujah. Thank you, Jesus.
I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about that part of
my
life.
I noticed. that's another whole show.
Right. Well, like you said, you got to revisit.
There you go. God bless you.
That'll be a show for a revisit.
Okay.
And this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I'm Deirdre Shuler, your host. And I want to thank my listeners for making my topic topically yours. And we want to thank, again, Keena.